Hello, welcome to Outside In. My name's John Burns, and this is my podcast for outdoor folk. I've got an author with me today who's written what I have to say is a rather beautiful book, Wild Waters, which is a wildlife and water lover's companion to the aquatic world. So she's probably no stranger to getting wet. I'm going to guess that. And so all the way from Sark, I think. Hello, Susan, how are you?
Hi, I'm good, thanks.
I'm all right, you don't mind getting wet, is that right? Or was that just an assumption?
It's true, I do swim outdoors all year round. And I also go paddleboarding, but then also being around water is also, it's also something that's there when you, if you enjoy going for walks, whether that's with your dog. My old dog needed to swim every day, so we always went to the beach or the river at least once a day. So being around the waterside is something that you don't have to get wet to enjoy the wildlife that's there.
No, you're right. I'm sure you're right. I'm sure you're right. I spend most of my time in the outdoors trying to keep dry. But well, when did your fascination with water and with wild places begin then?
Well, I suppose my mum is Swiss, and in the summers we would go over to Switzerland and meet up with the Swiss relatives. And it was just really standard practice there that in the summertime you swim in the lakes and the rivers. And so it wasn't wild swimming, it was just regular swimming.
Uh-huh.
And then my sister and I, we did used to dabble a bit in the river near where we lived, but there wasn't quite the culture of it in the same way. And then I was living in London, and when I had holiday, probably went abroad more than within England until I started going camping in England and really enjoyed it and found what you can see just as interesting and exciting as if you go somewhere remote, because it's different views and different wildlife inhabiting the place. So that's when I started to get more engaged with seeing and also finding out about what I was seeing here in Britain.
Right. And one of the chapters in your book looks at foraging. And that's mm-hmm. a really interesting concept, because, I mean, I live in the Highlands in Scotland, and there's a very strong tradition here of folk going down to the seashore and picking winkles or finding mussels. Mm-hmm. But is that something you can do all around the coast of Britain, or is it only certain areas? And what sort of things can you find?
Well, it's not just coastal, so because the book also looks at freshwater ecosystems. Mm-hmm. And what you find in those places has different flavors. And foraging is, you know, there are laws that do limit it. So
right,
you shouldn't be trespassing. You can pick in England and Wales the above ground parts of the plant, but not the root. You need the landowner's permission.
Oh, right. It's quite complicated then.
There's a couple of species that do have special protection under law, but they're not really ones that you would be eating so much here.
Yeah.
And there's also, you know, my feeling is that a nature reserve is a place where we can leave things be and we can find these things outside of nature reserves and enjoy them there. And certainly when you go and collect things, you shouldn't be going and stripping every fruit off a tree or every leaf of a plant. Really, it's responding to abundance and enjoying some of it. But you're also aware that other people may like to enjoy that. And, you know, these things are important for the wildlife around us as well. They rely on it. So it's thinking about, yes, there's abundance and you can partake of it, but then perhaps that creates obligation that you also take care of that that ecosystem, that place. And I did, when I did my master's research, I interviewed people who were picking wild plants and in the UK and using them to make beer and wine. And within the context of my research took place in was a lot of people who were, I was studying with, they went to do research sort of on indigenous leafy vegetables in Tanzania or ayahuasca use in Peru and much more exotic things. And I felt that actually here within England, Wales and Scotland, people are still using wild plants, but perhaps we're less aware of it. And perhaps it seems less exciting than these exotic things, but actually.
Yeah. So sorry, there are actually people picking aquatic plants to make wines and beers. Is that right? Did I get that right?
I just interviewed people about what they were using, and I don't think anyone was using specifically aquatic plants.
Right. Okay. Because I've not heard of that. Okay.
But I have myself incorporated aquatic plants into spirits, actually, because I sometimes work on ingredient selection for distilleries.
Oh, so right. Okay.
There's a couple for the Boatyard Distillery in Northern Ireland. The gin I selected bog myrtle because of the location of the distillery and the founder's childhood, you know, actually cutting peat on the bogs.
Right. Yeah.
So it was local and salient. And then for the Isle of Harris Distillery, I selected sugar kelp as the key botanical. So that's the seaweed.
Yes. And
that was to do with the association between the island and the importance of seaweed in the economy and in shaping the landscape because of its use as a fertilizer in crofting. So seaweed captured some of the character of the island. And then also sugar kelp has, as the name suggests, it is a little sweet. So it's a nice, slightly mellow flavor that works well in the context of a gin.
It's not even burgeoning. It's been doing quite well for a while. Actual sort of, I suppose, craft gin making is what you describe it as. But I didn't know that you could use things like seaweed. I know that for a long time, I could be wrong here, but I think was seaweed not used in, or type of seaweed used in brewing for a long time to actually clear the beer, or is that just something I dreamt?
It still is. It's called Irish moss or carrageenan. The scientific name is Chondrus crispus, and you'll find it quite easy on rocky seashores. And if you go to a home brewing shop in person or online, you'll see that you can still buy Irish moss, and it's used for clarifying beer because it's a gelling agent. So you use it in other food products too, and it will just catch sort of suspended particles and bring them down out of the liquids, because we associate clarity as as being safe to drink, and the association is that if your beer is cloudy, then perhaps there's another microbial dynamic in there, not just the yeast, and that the beer might be bad. So it's really something that's aesthetic, that had perhaps some foundation in food hygiene and food science, but it's become the way we're used to drinking beer as a clear drink.
Yeah. So there is quite a long history of people using aquatic plants in brewing and things like that. You obviously are someone who spent an awful lot of time in water, and that must have led you to some quite interesting encounters with marine wildlife. And I just wondered, is there anything that particularly sticks out in your mind? Any creature you've met that surprised you?
The last time I had a surprise was when I was on Neudart, swimming in the sea off Neudart Peninsula, and there was a lovely piece of sugar kelp, and I went to pick it up, and I hadn't actually really looked underneath, and as I picked up the sugar kelp, my finger got pinched quite hard by a crab that had been hiding underneath.
Right.
I thought, oh yeah, that I just forgot to think, oh, potentially there's a crab there. So that was a surprise.
And you must have had a lot of encounters with seals and things like that, have you?
Well, seals, there's, you have to be careful with seals because they can be really disturbed by people when they're on land, and you have to, so when I saw a seal pup out on the Monarch Isles, we were walking along the shore, and then we saw a seal pup, and then what we did was actually we went much further away because we, it was, and because if you're near a seal pup, the mum will, if she's seen you coming, she'll have gone in the water, but these pups, their coats aren't waterproof, so the pup can't go in the water, and the mum will watch you from the sea. And while she's watching you, she's anxious. She's not hunting for food. She's not feeding her pup.
Yes,
You've
that's right. That's right.
disturbed her essential functions. And also, if you're near the seal pup for too long, she'll make a decision, and she may cut her losses and abandon the pup. So you have to be really careful with seals on land, and also especially if you have dogs, because there was the seal who was he was worried, he was bitten by a dog, or mauled really. He was hauled out by the Thames, and then he had to be euthanized because his injuries were
Yes, I read
not.
about that. Yeah.
Yeah, and people, I have dogs, and you know your dogs, but also when a seal is on land, it's so vulnerable. They can't move that fast, and they can be injured. And also, if you see seals on land, whether you're passing them in a boat or if you're walking on shore, you do want to give them space because they can also get injuries if they rush off, if they stampede into the water in a hurry. They can, it's sort of tombstoning really, so they can actually break bones in their fins. And also when they're on land, what they're there doing is they're digesting, they're resting, and if you move them off the land, you've disturbed them. So on land, you really must, if you see them, just take some steps back and give them more space than you think they need, because if they just start jumping into the water, the damage is done. But on the other hand, when you're in water, what tends to happen with seals is they look at you become the object of interest to
Yes, that's
them,
right. That's right. I've heard a lot of.
because they are spectacularly wonderful swimmers. It looks so effortless. And what they tend to do is, and this is seals that are wild and not habituated to being around people a lot, but so up in the Monarch Isles again, I was swimming with some friends, and we knew there was a seal colony there, and we'd seen the seals in the distance, and they were looking at us. They were in the water and putting their head up and watching us across the water. And then we just carried on slowly swimming, and the seals were coming from behind or from the sides, and then they were swimming underneath us, sort of on their backs, looking up at us, and just they were sort of buzzing by, just watching, seeing what we were doing, curious, but very comfortable within themselves. And I know divers are up at the Farne Islands and places like that. There's seals that will come and sort of play with divers. They'll nibble their fins. But you've got to remember that if you're a diver, you're quite well padded and insulated with gloves and fins. And if you're a swimmer or a paddleboarder, you don't have that layer of protection. So seals that are used to playing with divers in that way, seal bites can have quite a bit of bacteria in them. So actually, you don't really want to be that close to seals. But you can enjoy them, but understand that they're big and powerful, that on land you can harm them on land, and that in the water you shouldn't chase them. You should just allow them to see you, and they should be free to swim away and carry on
I
with.
mean I've seen seals and seal pups right in the far north of Scotland, and you had to, well, it was quite an interesting experience. You have to sort of sneak up. And then a boulder moved, and I realized it was a seal. I had to back off pretty quick, but I was able to watch them with the seals with their pups, just by peeping over the cliff top, really. And the mothers didn't go back in the water, so they must have been pretty happy with me. But they knew I was there, but I think they were pretty happy with that. And I certainly have had seals watch me walk along the coast, and indeed where I overlook the River Ness in Inverness, and it's not that uncommon to see seals actually catching salmon in the river sort of just outside my door, really, which is a great thing, you know. What inspired you? What made you want to write this book? Because it's beautifully illustrated, and I think it would hook anybody into, I suppose, the kind of exploration of a secret world below the surface. Is that something that inspires you?
Yeah, I think it's partly there's a vulnerability when you start thinking about wildlife and water, because we breathe air, we don't breathe water.
Yeah.
So when we're in or around that environment, we're not really the apex of the food web that we imagine ourselves, because we don't have wolves and bears here in Britain anymore. So there's that vulnerability. And I used to get, you know, people would send me photos of jellyfish stings or welchy things on the beach to say, what's this? This hurts. How can I stop the sting from hurting? So we think,
I'll stop you there for a moment. I have heard that you wee on it. Is that right?
No, actually.
Oh, it's a myth. Oh, okay, go on.
I mean, this is something. So different jellyfish stings sort of sting to different degrees.
Right.
And the way they sting is the same mechanism, which is that they have venom in stinging cells, and the stinging cells attach to your skin. And when they're triggered, they'll sting you. So things that can trigger them are physical pressure, so brushing them off or brushing against them. Also changes in osmotic pressure. So if you were to rinse off an area where you've had a jellyfish tentacle on you with fresh water, that's the different balance of salt in the water is a change in osmotic pressure. So then you can trigger stinging cells. So with urine, depending on how much a person's been drinking and what they've been drinking and how their kidneys are working, you get very different concentrations of salt.
It depends on the wee, basically, does it? Is that what you're saying?
It depends on the wee, but also it doesn't actually help you. But what does help, so there was some research conducted, I think it was University of Galway, and they looked at lion's mane jellyfish stings.
All right.
And they tested, you know, treating them. And what they found works was vinegar. So that's slightly acidic, and also heat. So that's like putting a heat pack or a hot water bottle or, you know, a hot shower. You're denaturing the venom. So you're changing, you're rendering the molecules within the venom ineffective, and that stops the sting.
Ah, well, sorry to sidetrack you there, but I thought that was an interesting point. So, sorry, we were talking about that's very useful information, though. So going around weeing on people is not a good idea, right? But going back to when you started to write this book, what was it you wanted to do? What was your aim in it?
So, I mean, the seed was planted by, I've been writing columns about wildlife for Outdoor Swimmer magazine, and in that, just profiling individual species. But then there's the wider context of the different habitats that are here in Britain and Ireland that you can see. And then also really thinking about, as a person, how are you situated in relation to this wildlife? And, you know, in the first chapter in the book, what I really look at is how even when you're on dry land, even at home in the city, there's lots of services and functions given to you by aquatic wildlife. So every other breath, really, you're using oxygen from dinoflagellates, which are microscopic plants that live in the sea. I know the rainforest gets much press, but the microscopic life actually gives us our breath just as much. And when you look at the development of aspirin, the discovery of the most commonly used painkiller, actually, the chemical pathway was worked out from two waterside plants, willow and meadowsweet, and now it's synthesized. It's not derived from those plants now. And you know, if you eat farmed salmon, a lot of the organic farmed salmon uses wild-caught wrasse as cleaner fish to take the sea lice off the salmon. So there's a lot of actually hidden wildlife trade within our life. So it's kind of thinking about, oh, actually we are connected to this wildlife and we use it in some ways not very wisely. And then going on from that, thinking about, well, how can you go and see it and discover it and get to know it, not just sort of receive benefits from it without realizing what it is, but to actually feel connected to it, and then make informed decisions about how can you see it without harming it, and does it change how you might, things you might eat or things you might do in your everyday life if you know more about how you're connected to these kinds of wildlife around water and these landscapes.
Yeah, I think we're only, well, I wouldn't say only just beginning, but I think in terms of the public consciousness, we're only now trying to get across to people that the sea is not this vast, I suppose, impenetrable wilderness that really can absorb everything and anything we do to it. It's actually a very fragile environment. And I was up in the seas north of Mull, trying to see a whale, but I didn't see a whale, but I saw loads of dolphins, which mm-hmm. was a fantastic sight, really. But that, you're very conscious that the kind of populations of basking shark and a lot of marine wildlife that once did populate that area is now relatively rare. Do you think that's true?
Yeah. So, I mean, if we look at the example of basking sharks, sort of the Isle of Man and that sort of passageway from Cornwall up to the Isle of Man and up along the sort of between the Inner and Outer Hebrides, that's often referred to as the basking shark capital of the world.
Oh, right. I didn't know that. Okay.
Yeah, they really do travel up there. So you see them down in Cornwall around sort of May time, and then they're up at the Isle of Man, August. But what happens is, although basking sharks, you know, theoretically protected in our waters and in certain regions, these are migratory species, and they travel through waters where they're not protected or where the legislative protection is not necessarily enforced, or it's very difficult to enforce. And actually, basking sharks, their livers are very rich in squalene, which actually it has been used a lot in cosmetics and sun care, so you know, sun protection cream. Mm-hmm. And there are now plant-based alternatives. However, it's also used, a small amount is used as an adjuvant in vaccines. So again, it's, you know, we have this wildlife that we think is rare and unusual. It doesn't just belong to us in Britain. We're sharing it with many people. We're also sharing it with people who catch them, and it's an important livelihood for them. And also, we're also making use of the squalene from their livers in mm-hmm. skincare and vaccines. So it's really, it's one of those things where you sort of have to think about how we do actually use quite a lot of wildlife in our everyday life. And some of it, you maybe start making choices and you think, well, you can use the plant-based alternative in sun cream, potentially in a vaccine, the way adjuvants work, you can't switch plant-based squalene as an alternative for shark liver-derived squalene. But then you might say, well, perhaps we say where it can be replaced, we use the alternative, and where it absolutely can't be replaced, and it's used in these tiny amounts, then we use it, but then we have to work harder to protect these animals at all other levels.
Yeah, I mean it's I don't want to get into the sort of the whole fishing debate, but we certainly have, I would say, pretty ruthlessly exploited our oceans for a long, long time, and you know, and we certainly can't do that forever. It's we're now very close to reaping the war, the disaster that we've caused, really. But anyway, if one message from your book, you obviously, I think people in value an environment the more they understand it, and the more that it becomes part of their lives and sort of valuable to them. What would you say to folk who maybe don't know much and don't get to the sea very much, or don't get to water a lot? How would you encourage them to go and explore places safely and responsibly?
Well, I mean, firstly, I'd say some of the sort of wildlife successes in recent years are things like otters in the canals around Birmingham, and appearing up in Sheffield in the River Don. So even in the city, you can be surprised by actually how vibrant some of, and perhaps charismatic some of the wildlife
Yes.
you'll find around a bog standard canal can be. And also,
Well, right now, if you think about it, if you talk about the wildlife like otters, I mean, there's been, as you know, there's a resurgence for the beaver in the Highlands at the moment, and has been going on for a few years now. And I think that because now we're looking at the effect of what we've been doing to the landscape in terms of felling trees and in terms of improved drainage, which is causing massive flooding. And of course, the beaver coming back, we hope will have a big role in that. Have you explored beaver very much in your book?
I haven't in the book because they're not that widespread. So I've focused a bit more on things that people are more
Right,
likely to
okay.
see. But I'd say if there was a second edition, I think in a couple of years, yes. I do mention a bit about, I think in the chapter on foraging, about castoreum, which used to be used as a flavouring in things like strawberry ice cream, which actually came from the glands of beavers.
Wow, I didn't know that. Okay.
It's this concentrated aromatic product which beavers use to show their sort of prowess and how good they are at foraging and finding a range of things that they're eating, and that makes them
All
able
right,
to.
okay.
So it's used in marking, and it's unfortunate for them that at some point someone decided that it tasted good used as a flavoring in foods for humans.
All right, okay.
So that wasn't great for beavers, but they are, what's interesting about them is that despite they seem small, they're actually, like a lot of wildlife, landscape engineers, and
Ah,
they
yeah.
exert changes on the environment. And in the case of beavers, the way they shape water courses and build dams,
Yeah.
and the way, oh, sorry about that. Just have to unplug it,
Yeah, no worries. No worries.
I think. Okay, it stopped. So the way beavers shape landscapes, we benefit in terms of flood control, and they also, the way they chew trees is a bit like coppicing, so you get this young tree growth too. And there's lots of species that do things like that. So the way otters will eat urchins and fish, and that has an impact on the kelp beds, and the way kelp beds actually, because of their flexibility in the way they move in the water, kelp beds can actually absorb a lot of wave energy. So during storm surges, kelp beds actually shelter the land and diminish the impact of wave, extreme wave action on the land. So there's, lots of invisible things that wildlife does for us on the
See,
land.
it's quite incredible when you think of it. It sounds to me as though actually you could have written several books, really, because there is such a well, there is such a diversity and such a complexity about the marine environment and our rivers and the way I suppose rivers have shaped us and we've shaped rivers. And it's interesting to think that actually rivers that we see now are rivers without beavers, and they would look very different if we had a beaver population. So marine wildlife has a profound influence on us. Well, listen, thank you for talking to me. It's been a it really is a lovely book. I think it brings alive an environment that most people wouldn't normally see, and gives you angles on it, I think, that you wouldn't expect. You've certainly told me some things I didn't know today. So your book, Wild Waters, Our Wildlife and Water Lover's Companion to the Aquatic World, that's available through Vertebrate. And Suzanne Masters, thank you very much for talking to me. It's been absolutely fascinating.
Thank you, John.